Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features the phenomenal Nosibele Mayaba, who bears it all in her memoir, Positively Me, Daring to Live and Love Beyond HIV, co-authored with Sue Nyati. Born in Klabega in the 1990s, this popular AIDS activist's upbringing was one of struggle and strife. She was raised by the tough hand of her mother in the confines of a strict Christian household. Nosibele strove to be the good girl that everybody adores to win her mother's approval and the affection of her absent father. She lived by the book and was steered by her faith. Hers became a life of firsts. She was the first person in her family to travel overseas, the first to graduate from university. It is also her first love, with his infectious smile that infected her with HIV. This diagnosis throws her life into disarray. Fearing stigma and feeling the need to maintain her good girl image, she kept her status a secret. However, she soon succumbed to depression. It is in the aftermath, when she picks up the broken pieces of her life, that she finds purpose in all the pain she has endured. She went public with her story in a video that went viral and launched her onto a new path. Nosibele, who has since got married and recently become a mother, has made it her mission to hold open conversations about her journey with HIV. In this episode of PageCast, she's joined in conversation with seasoned media practitioner Sebenzile Nkambule. Enjoy.
Well, hello, hi, and thank you very much for joining us for this this podcast episode. My name is Sebenzile Nkambule. I am a journalist. I work in broadcasting as well as philanthropy in the media space in Southern Africa. I'm very excited and a little nervous, in fact, to be in conversation today. And I'll tell you why in just a bit. But I'm in conversation with Nosibele Mayaba, who is an HIV activist, internationally recognized podcaster, speaker, and TV host. A TV show, hashtag Yes, I Have HIV on Honey, helped many to disclose their HIV statuses to their loved ones. And Nosibele lives in Johannesburg with her husband and son. May I call you Nosy? Is that all right?
That'll make me feel more comfortable.
Okay, great. I don't want to be, you know, we get familiar so quickly. You're also such an open and a known figure as well. And I think that's also when I mentioned a moment ago that I'm nervous because you're so open, right? We are not, I think South Africans in general, right? I'm generalizing to make the point. I think we still remain quite a conservative bunch. I mean, you would say perhaps that the younger lot, that my 2000 as you would call them, that I think break the rules in many ways. But we are a very conservative society and we want to, I think, move towards breaking that a lot more. And I suppose that's also what you are doing through your story, through your presence on YouTube and you know, across the social platforms that you occupy. And then, of course, now through this body of work or your story now, you know, put in book form. Congratulations, firstly. We'll talk about the writing process as well, what that was like, the support you received for that. But I'd like to start here, and I was toying with, do we start with this particular theme at the end, or you know, kind of bring it at the end, or should we start with it? And I think starting with it makes sense. Mm. You are a person, you're a woman of faith, mm-hmm. and even in the book that comes across quite strongly, I think as you take us from your early years, bringing us to the present, and you know, the older you get, the stronger the faith. Also, mm. I think is how you depict that. So, if you could share what is your faith, how would you characterize?
I am a believer. I'm Christian. I believe God, designed or Jesus to die for my sins, and yeah, that's who I believe. I pray a lot. And obviously, growing up though, it started, you know, having to go to church every Sunday. It was not an option. Mama literally is like, if you're not going to go to church, then my house is going to be locked and you just kind of have to see what you're going to do with yourself. So, because obviously we don't want to linger around, we might as well go to church. So for a long time, I do believe that It was something that was forced initially, that this is how we are going to conduct ourselves, you know, in our household. I'll be very honest that it was quite difficult growing up at like that at first, because I felt let me just say it was in the way that Christianity was introduced to me at first. Ne? We are not allowed to ask questions. We just need to do what our parents tell us to do and the pastor tells us to do. And the pastor and the church is also going to tell us how we dress, how we speak, to some degree influence who we marry or how we even marry, right? Mm-hmm. But I was so thankful over time I got to develop my own relationship with God and my own relationship with Jesus, to say, hey, actually, it's not what I've come to know when I was growing up. It's not forced. It's a relationship that can freely come. You can ask questions. You can, if you don't understand something, it's okay to ask and get clarity on that. So I think it was in grade 10 when that started to happen to me, when I went to a Christian school. And that honestly opened myself up to what I believe Christianity and believing in God should look like. It's once again, it's not something that should be forced. And it's actually liberated me in that regard. And obviously that influenced how I would come to further develop in my journey. It helped me when I was going through, you know, my process of healing after I was diagnosed with HIV. I don't know what I would have done if that was not there, that strong foundation was not there. So yeah, I want to believe that summarizes just my religion and what I believe in and where it stems from.
It's often also the source of the judgment that also comes, right, with identifying as Christian. You speak about the way in which you were forced belief, right, into the religion itself. But it's interesting now you're almost grateful for that. Do you think though there could be a better way, perhaps, to introduce young people in particular, and maybe not only young people, but different people, people who always feel different, who are othered, whether it's because of how they look, their choices in life, and so on. Is there a way that particularly the Christian faith can be more inclusive or more embracing of people?
Absolutely. I think we actually even need to start from the beginning, because the other thing I think that is influenced by is like individual interpretation of how things should be. Because I'll make a very silly example. So we were not allowed to wear pants in our household, in our church. We were not allowed to wear pants. And apparently that was based on a scripture in Deuteronomy that says men should not wear women's clothing and women should not wear men's clothing. So pants were categorized as man's clothing. So for a woman to wear it, it was not biblically correct, right? I don't wear skumbuzos, my husband's pants. I wear Nozi's pants. Woman's pants, right? So it's about the interpretation of what each person believes is right. That I think that's where we should be. We should start and be open in conversing in that regard. I think that's where the problem starts, where we are so rigid in our own beliefs of what we believe is right, that we are not open to anything else. I absolutely, absolutely advocate for, can we be more softer? Can we be more inclusive? Can we be more understanding? I'm not saying understanding sin or whatever, but because that's what the gospel should be. In the way that with disciplined people, it should be out of love, not out of anger. Do you get what I mean? So I do believe that that's what Christianity should stand for. Even when we discipline, we should be disciplining out of love, not from a place of anger or discrimination.
Because you have been quite open about your status, about 5 years now, right? That's
yes.
Since you've been public about it.
Yeah.
for and you have a huge following on YouTube. I watched a number of your videos and so on. So it's wonderful. For folks who, and not only those who are only being introduced to you now, but those who have been following you, they may make the assumption that this is a book about HIV, but it's not. It's a life story. It's a story of a very young life at that. So walk me through the process of writing. You're also very young, and often we think people should only really chronicle their lives when you are, you know, one foot in the grave. But yeah. Even then, it might even still be too soon. But you know, there's so much life still ahead for you, and you're very young as well. What now? And what would you say to a person who says, "Oh, here we go again, a book about HIV"?
No. So when you open the book, I think the first message I say is to the reader, may you find parts of yourself in my story, or may you find parts of yourself in this book, because I believe it's not only about the HIV story. Obviously, definitely it was inspired by that because I was going through a lot of things, you know, trying to come to terms with what the diagnosis means. But as I was busy, at first it was, the idea was not to write a book at all. As I was going through therapy, counseling, I was advised or I was encouraged to write, right? I was encouraged to just pour out my feelings. And only then I thought to myself, hang on a sec, this is actually something possibly, hopefully, it could help another person going through something similar or could go through something similar. And that's where the inspiration behind the book came from. But as I started now, honestly, writing, there's so much about the book that, once again, it's beyond the HIV diagnosis. For example, I could not make justice to my story if I did not pay tribute to my mom's story. Because that's initially where it starts, right? There's so much dynamics with my mom's story that influences who I am and continues to influence who I am. I could not give my story any justice if I did not explain where I come from when it comes to my father's side. Because we know traditionally in the Black culture, the identity of a child comes from the father, right? But with me, it was so difficult that because as a result of our birth, my brother and I, we were a result of an affair, right, between our parents. My dad was married. My mom was a divorcee. So now we are born out of wedlock and we don't know where we belong. Right. Mm. Do we take my father's name? Do we take his clan name? To what degree do I have ownership of his family? So we were those kids that did not belong anywhere. We were those kids that were not recognized. We were those kids that, it's those kids. And that kind of influenced how I suddenly developed into this person where, okay, if I'm not going to get recognized or acknowledged by my father and his family, then I'm going to seek this validation or acknowledgement everywhere else. So I will be that girl that was overly the top with her personality. She walks into a room, you can't ignore her. She walks into the room, you can't miss her. Her loud laugh, her loud voice, because there was that yearning to be recognized, to be acknowledged by someone because of it was not done where I needed it the most. And I know a lot of South Africans, actually just a lot of people in general, will find some kind of relevance with that. Because unfortunately we live in that kind of society even now, even today in 2024. I talk a lot about my career. I talk about what influenced my need to be this overachiever, right? Because unfortunately, It's simple things. My mom is not educated, cannot read or write, but she still wanted that for herself, right? So now that she did not have that opportunity to do so, then she's going to channel all of that energy to me, but not realizing that she's pushing me so hard that I could never feel that I was doing enough. How many of us can relate to that? So those are some of the topics that I touch on that someone I absolutely believe that someone will relate to that. So it goes beyond HIV. Definitely goes beyond HIV.
It absolutely does. It really does. On that point about belonging, do you feel like you belong now? Where are you on that front?
I feel like I do belong. I'll be very honest, it only happened after I got married and now I had my son. Only then. Interestingly enough, The other day, I was having a heart-to-heart with my husband and our friends. And I said to them, although now I see the need to balance everything, right? Because now that I have the family, I've always wanted for myself, it kind of feels like, okay, no one else matters. This is the priority for me, right? No one else matters. I should be focusing on my son and I should be focusing on my household. I should be focusing on building my own family. I'll be honest, only now that I'm married and have a son that I feel like I belong. I feel like I'm someone's mom. I have that kind of responsibility and that won't change, that I feel like I'm needed. I feel like I matter. I feel like I'm important because of that.
You're spot on about that, you know, how a book about your own life is also the stories of the characters, right? In your life, your mom, your cousins, your aunts, your brother, Smoo. It's everybody here, your father as well. Did you reflect on that? What it would mean and how much of their stories you would share through telling your own story, because also their own stories are theirs to tell.
I'll be very honest that I've never had an opportunity to tell my story, my own version of, actually, this is how it made me feel. Dada, do you remember when you were holding my hand right in front of your shop? If for you, it might have been like a simple gesture because you didn't want me to run off across the street or whatever. But you don't realize that that was some kind of acknowledgement for me as a child that, oh, he sees me. He sees me as a child, or he sees me as his daughter. Yeah? My stepmom, right? I understand that you were possibly not given the full picture of, you know, how many kids he has, or what does it entail to marry this person with many kids and many baby mamas. But in your quest to protect your own family, in your quest to see how you can navigate this journey, it also hurt me in the process. Mm. It also hurt me in the process. I think I'll be very honest. First and foremost, it was about me. It was about acknowledging how I felt in the situation. It was acknowledging my own journey. Unfortunately, it had to bring in, you know, these different parties who may have a different version of saying, but that's not how I meant it to be like, or that's not how I recall it. It's okay. It's my story though. And I think that was that's what I focused on when I was writing the book.
And in particular, I wondered about Smoo, right? Maybe introduce to the listener who Smoo is, and then I'll follow up on why that particular question was, it was on everybody, your mom and everybody, because it's all of their stories. But with him in particular, I thought, I wonder what the thinking process there was.
I'm going to also follow up with something quite interesting that happened right after, just about when we were about to finish the book. So for anyone that doesn't know who Smoo is in the book, Smoo is my then boyfriend who I met him 2010, but we started dating, you know, 2011 or so, 2012. And at the time, I was, you know, keeping myself for marriage on all respects, you know, and I'm not going to engage in any sexual activity and all of that. And at first he did understand, but over time, you know, you are able to manipulate the language of how someone is saying something or what they believe in. And eventually, you know, we engaged in sex, and it was the last thing on my mind to protect myself. Although I did know what HIV was, definitely, but there was a level of being naive and I guess in love at the time. And a couple of months later, I was diagnosed with HIV. And at first, I did want to believe, maybe I didn't know, but hey, it's getting a little bit fishy. Because I don't understand. Now that I recall, when we had discussed testing, he was going to test on his own. I was going to test on my own. Now this is thinking after realizing I was diagnosed with HIV. He never forwarded me his test results. And there's so much about him now that I'm questioning. There's now girls around, you know, drinking excessively and so many different things. So in a nutshell, sorry to make it long, Smoo is the guy that infected me with HIV, right? I know what your question is going to be in terms of, because we did discuss this. I remember as we were about to finish the book, my publisher came to me and said, hey, so we might have to change a couple of things because, for example, you mentioned where you work, you know, you mentioned that there was some kind of relation between you and school around, you know, where you guys worked. So we might have to tailor it so that legally people don't piece it together in terms of who Smoo is and all of that. I mean, this is 10 years later, but I don't want to lie. That made me mad. That honestly made me angry. I was pissed off for quite some time. I don't understand why I need to protect this person. I mean, I've done very well in terms of obviously legally and just me personally. There was no need to mention his real name and all of that. It's just having to take that extra step to protect him. That made me, I don't want to lie, that made me very, I had a few choice words, you know. But eventually, obviously, at the advice of the publisher, we went ahead with the suggestion. But yeah, it left a sour taste in my mouth that after all these years, I still need to be protecting, being careful and all of that for someone that I believed was not careful or thoughtful about my story or about me many years ago, to some degree, even today.
You're not clear in the book whether or not you know if he knew prior to your getting together. Which is it? Do you believe that he knew?
Oh, definitely. He knew. I truly believe that he knew. I don't have proof in terms of I saw his positive HIV results before or during that time, but it's so many things. It is one, as I mentioned, not forwarding me his test results when I forwarded mine. It is about how he was never remorseful even after the HIV diagnosis. How the doctor asked us to protect ourselves. So from here on, you use protection so that you don't reinfect each other. Even at the doctor's advice, he will still manipulate and make me feel bad about, oh, but you know, we don't need to, or this is making me uncomfortable. How about we? It's so many different things. Even after we had broken up or he broke up with me or whatever the case may be, he continued to live his best life without any care in the world while I was trying to pick up the pieces. For someone who's human, for someone who's honestly human and understands also where I come from, because I didn't have anyone that I could relate the story to. I could not tell my family for 6 years. So it was many different things, and those that made me believe he knew. Intentionally, he infected me. For what? I don't know, but I strongly believe he knew.
And did you consider at all pursuing, you know, wanting to establish that fact? And thereafter, as we know, if you intentionally infect someone, right? I mean, you could be facing a very serious case. Did your mind go there? Because also the sequence of events suggests that that isn't the case, right? And to my earlier point about wanting to, I suppose, to understand how it plays out, because one often thing when you're not living in it, and this is to my point about being nervous at the beginning, is that we can speak at a very high level data, information. This is what the stats say. This is what, you know, the Department of Health says. This is what social workers would say. And this is what we're taught in life orientation, whatever it is at school. Mm. So at that very intellectual level, one would then say, but Nozi, come on, right? You were careless. Why weren't you a lot more vigilant? Why, you know, just from reading that. But as we then realize, given how and our numbers as well of late in terms of our infection rate are going a direction that we don't want it to go. When you think about the investment made over the years from the crisis in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, to the interventions over the years. And then now we're again at a point where particularly young women are getting infected. You know, that trend is rising quite a bit. So I think that's why I think we should all remove ourselves from the what we should all do to a, well, in the moment when you know, as Nozi, this is what you should do, you don't do that. What might it be? what could influence that, do you think?
I was giving a talk in Kenya in February. And one of the things that I wanted to focus on was we need to make sure that when it comes to our HIV interventions, there are representatives of the realities that are in our communities. Yeah. Firstly, in South Africa, we live in one of the most patriarchal society ever in the world. We have one of the highest GBV rates in the world, right? There's so many gender inequalities that we first need to deal with before we even deal with anything else. So we can't separate HIV interventions from all of those things. I worked in an NGO for many years, and one of the things that we did offer HIV services, testing, prenatal classes and all of that. So I'll make a very simple example. It is government regulation that when a woman is pregnant, they should also, among other things, they should test for HIV. But it is not mandatory for any man to test for HIV.
Mm.
So now the woman tests HIV positive in a clinic. We automatically do counseling. We already empower them with, okay, you're going to take your ARVs. This is what you should do to protect your child. They go back home. They're not working. Their economic inequalities within the household. Yeah. So they are being forced in a situation where they have to even hide to take ARVs. How do we expect that woman to thrive in that kind of situation? So it's those things where our interventions are amazing in terms of we need to make sure we target young girls. We need to make sure we target, women. Abantwana, they don't get pregnant on their own. We have the highest pregnancy rate in South Africa. They don't get pregnant on their own, abantwana. They actually are empowered enough in terms of how they should protect themselves, but they get into relationships with much older men that are more experienced, that are forcing them in these kind of situations. So what I'm trying to say is, once you take those different factors into consideration, that even when I was empowered and told that I should not engage in sexual activity without using protection, now that I'm HIV positive, I still went ahead and still had unprotected sex right after the doctor said, because I felt like I did not have any kind of power in the relationship. If I didn't do that, Sebenzile, that guy would have left me, and I wouldn't have known what to do with myself.
Mm.
I can't tell my family because of fear of discrimination. I wouldn't have known what to do with myself. So I think, yeah, it doesn't make it right. I still, to this day, take full responsibility of my involvement and in the story, in terms of, you could have done a little bit more to make sure that you get his results, right? Even if he goes beyond of giving you fake results, but you would have taken that extra step. You could have persisted on having your own condoms so that you don't rely on him to buy condoms, so many different things. I definitely acknowledge that, and I take full responsibility, but we can't ignore the realities of the community that we live in. And that impacts the kind of decisions that a lot of women find themselves taking in these situations.
It's so powerful what you're saying. It's so powerful because there's the so-called what's right and what's wrong, but reality is somewhere in the middle, right?
Yeah.
And all of these factors that are at play in any given moment. It's
absolutely.
You know, I really have the chills from that response. Just to close off the loop, I think in the conversation with Spoo, right? So for the people who knew you all when you were still together, it may be a lot of people, it may be a handful of people, but there are people who, from hearing your story, watching your videos, reading the book, would know who he is, from that time. Do you feel at any level, accountable for however they may perceive him? And how they may perceive you for sharing the story to say, but Nozi, is it really the world's business to know what transpired with you?
No. And that's an honest answer, to be honest. No. And I'll be very honest because I don't want to lie. Not at any, even one moment when I started sharing my story back in 2019, where I felt some kind of responsibility and obligation for him or anyone else. Because at the time, it was actually, once again, about me and my story and potentially how many people I can help with my story. Because also I felt, even though he never said anything, for the 6 years that I was quiet, I felt like he had some kind of power, a hold over me, because he knew, Bana, it's only the two of us that know about the story. So I felt like I couldn't do a lot of things because psychologically still has a hold over me that I know something that a lot of people don't know. It's something that you're hiding. So I felt like immediately when I came out with my story, I acknowledged my story or whatever the case may be, I took that power back. I took that power back. I felt I'd given him a part of myself that I needed something back for me. So I'll be very honest. For anyone who's listening or watching, I'm sorry. I understand possibly where you're coming from, but no, I did not feel any kind of, I didn't feel anything. And I continue not to feel anything.
I love the honesty. Is the stigma still there though, Nozi? I think to your earlier response about the very tough socioeconomic conditions that that many young women in particular live in, there's still a lot of shame that is attached, right, to living with HIV. And again, you know, going back to when we, you know, think about the interventions, you know, shows like Soul City that were so important, you know, over the years, and then later on a show like Gazlam, for example. Was it Gazlam, or which one was it that actually, Intersections,
I think it was. Soul City. Yeah, I think those are the two ones that come to mind.
The two that stand out. I don't know why Gazlam comes to mind. But yes, Intersections, I think, was the later one.
Yeah.
Where very powerful storytelling that shows you how we are exposed without even knowing, without even realizing.
Yeah.
But then also it those sort of shows were able to penetrate the youth culture of the respective times. I don't think there's anything right now. I don't know, but perhaps you may be more informed about it, that's actually speaking to the current moment. And I think those sort of shows allowed for openness, allowed for conversations to be had in the home in ways that, you know, when really the stigma was at its worst, that wasn't the case. What would be your assessment of where we are currently as a country? Like, do you, everyday, day-to-day life, for people who know you and know your status, is it a constant embrace and an openness, or does it come up where you still see the being shunned or being excluded for things because there are some people who are still like, ooh, I don't want to get too close, I may catch this thing?
So it definitely evolved from where we are. Where we were, rather, in the, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, that one was more about, you know, you can't touch a person. You're very skeptical of using utensils that this person is using. So you don't want to be associated with this person, just in case people think also now you're also HIV positive or you have AIDS or whatever, right? Now, there is a level of common sense when a 7-0 to say, so there are ARVs. Yeah? People can get healthy and live a longer life. To some degree, there are interventions that are in place that people can be healthy and have families and so forth. I think it goes back to your earlier point. Nozi is educated. She had a medical aid. She worked at a multinational company. She went to Germany. Sent that she's well accomplished. How in the world did she find herself in that situation? That's the discrimination that it comes in that form. The reason why I'm saying it's discrimination, because a CEO of another multinational company is then thinking to themselves, "Yo, I get that means I also can't come out. I also can't disclose my HIV status because I should have known better. Guys, there's no face to what HIV is. There's no face. Because it comes in different forms, man. I walk into a room and I tell my story. And then the next thing is like, sure, it was such a powerful story. Yo, I wouldn't have thought. Why?
Why?
Because I look a certain way, because I speak a certain way, because I carry myself, because I dress in a certain way. Why? Mm. Why? Right. So it definitely has moved. Once again, it has evolved, but it's in those subtle comments. It's in the you should have known better. But why in 2024 would you be infected? Like, it doesn't make sense. We've had HIV for quite some time. You should have enough information to make a better decision for yourself. True. But once again, touching on all those different, topics and dynamics, we find ourselves still with a high HIV rate in South Africa, right? Mm-hmm. So also the other day, almost 2 weeks ago. Now I've come to, terms with my story that there's nothing you can tell me that would faze me at all. She's HIV positive. Oh, okay, whatever. She's this and that. Oh, okay. It is what it is. But now I have a child, ne? He's 11 months. And I'm someone also who's very much, hey, look at him, he's so cute, right? because I'm a first-time mom, you know? In Xhosa we say that. I'm overwhelmed by everything he does, right? I'm just being this cute person. So someone, there was a fake account that over time has gained a lot of followers. And they posted a picture of me and Lumi and said, I bet the child also has AIDS. Yeah? So it was shared about 2,500 times. I think there was about 3,000 comments. It gained traction. Definitely gained traction. I mean, I'm honestly not fazed because I truly believe whoever the person is, there is a level of common sense to know what is true. However, it was in the way of how they were able to manipulate and pinpoint exactly what to say to gain traction and get people talking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still there. It's still there. The discrimination is still there, and I think it will still continue to be there because we have definitely put the HIV conversation, on the side because there's been more pressing issues, COVID, and any other issue that we faced over the last couple of years, that we've kind of put it on the side banner. So until we see the need, the urgency, and the importance of bringing those conversations back, we'll still be faced with such problems, with such discrimination.
Mm. And from that fake post, did you go through the comments and the responses? What were people saying? Were you encouraged by people standing up for you and calling out and educating this fellow? And were there also a lot of those who perhaps also shared the same nonsense?
No, Shame. I'll be very honest. Probably about 99.9% of people were livid. Like, I've never. They had a couple of choice words. No. They were livid. They were absolutely angry. They were honestly, I could feel it. It's not like they were trying to buy face or anything like that. I could literally feel how angry they were. Right. But I think also, Shane, for me, I knew where it was coming from. I saw the post, but my thing is like, I'm not going to engage. I'm honestly not going to give it like any further attention that it should. So now people are trying to tag me on the post and bring the post to my attention. I'm like, okay, I love you to bits, but please don't tag me on these things. Protect at all costs. I know you're coming from a good place, but honestly, you do not need to tag me on such things. But honestly, a lot of people, I'll be very honest, they were defending, they were swearing at this person. And they were angry. They were honestly angry.
What do you think coming out about your status has cost you?
Everything. How I've now had to understand that it was not, as much as the story was about me, as I said earlier on, that I felt it was important for me personally about my identity, where I come from, who I am, what I've had to go through. But it was also at the expense of my family. It was at the expense of my in-laws. It was at the expense of my husband, my mom, who is very, you know, particular about how she's seen in the community, how she's seen at church. What will this mean to her, right? So it did, I mean, it was quite tough. It was tough. I remember her crying when I told her. And I think it was a week after I told her, I came out with the I Am Still Me video. So she was still coming to terms with the diagnosis. And here I was also publishing a YouTube video. Like, Yonkindo is happening at the same time, right? And then people have something to say, my distant families, people at church, people in the community. So it was quite tough. It was quite tough. But it was still very much important for me to do so. It was literally that moment when, what's the English word? Is it, you know, when that process of having to stop a baby from breastfeeding, right? It's literally also Yes. Taking the child away. There's that moment you're like, now they have to, you know, there's a level of independence that they're going to have that, I'm not needed there, right? It's uncomfortable for both mother and child. So I think that's where my mom and I were at, that, girl, I understand where you're coming from. I really do. But this is still my story to tell. It's not yours. It's not yours. I'll still consider you. I'll still support you. But there's a level of letting go that you need to do. But it worked out. Things could have really gone bad. But things really went well, right? And because now she counsels her peers that found themselves in similar situations. And it's the most beautiful thing, right? Oh. Hey, I just spoke to so-and-so. Hey, nosy. You don't know how many people you are helping. I'm like, okay. Wow. And it's the most sweetest thing ever, right?
Yeah. And I think you've started to answer this next question. What has coming out gifted you with?
Firstly, it has, what can I call it? It liberated me. I felt, honestly, literally, I felt like the cup. I don't know how to say this in English, but I'm light. I'm light, you know, there's no hold over me. But it has also gifted me with this new level of relationship that I got to discover between my mom and I, right? Between so many different people, actually, my brother and I. We've become more close. I've got to really understand what it is like to have a brother that would protect you at all costs. A husband that is very intentional about protecting his wife from his family, from his own family, that this is the person that I decided to spend my life with, whether or not to get HIV positive, that has nothing to do with anything, one or the other. I think that I could summarize it like that.
Do you have a copy of the book with you? Page 239.
Okay.
And if you can read from the paragraph that starts with, of course.
Ah, Lord, I hope I'm not going to be emotional, okay? Okay, so I'm reading from page 239 of my book. Of course, I still struggle to understand many things about my life, why Ma always had to be so hard on me. Did I have to be valued for my labor and the money I could bring in? In her own way, I know Ma loves me and that she has made so many sacrifices for me. I think what she has given up may never be as great as what I will have to give up during my lifetime. I do love Ma. I always will. I forgive her for what I do not always comprehend. Sometimes in my quiet moments, I do wish that my life didn't have to always be such an uphill climb. And then at the same time, I realize that this is the life that made me and which enables me to pull others up now. I'm grateful for how Ma raised me and Malatis, who has, through that strength, figured out his life. I'm grateful that Ma opened our home to Zipo, who has sadly passed away. It is because of Ma that I had her in my life, my sister cousin. Most of all, I'm grateful to be loved by my supporters and most especially by school and my son. Today, I no longer look at the world and see judgment. Instead, I am here to give the same love and support to others that has been given so generously to me.
I thought that passage truly captures the story in its entirety, at least this part of your life, because there's so much more. That was an excerpt from Positively Me, Daring to Live and Love Beyond HIV by Nosbele Mayaba with Sue Nyati. And you can, of course, get the book at all good bookstores and online. It truly has been a pleasure, Nozi. Nyabonga for this opportunity. You are light and continue to being the light in the world.
That was amazing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.